Case number 223289, Andrea Goldblum versus University of Cincinnati. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Engel, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. We'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
May it please the court. The University of Cincinnati fired its Title IX coordinator, Andrea Goldblum, for sending a letter to the school newspaper, despite an instruction to do so, not to do so from her supervisor. The university has asked this court to look no further. Under the university's analysis of the case, no more is needed. She was insubordinate, so she can be fired. End of story. But that is, we respectfully suggest, not the end of the story. Because Ms. Goldblum alleges that the decision to terminate her was retaliatory, that it was designed to quash criticism of the university for admitting and honoring a convicted sex offender in violation of Title IX. And there are significant reasons to doubt the legitimacy of UC's justification. These include the university's prior disciplinary practices, the fact that the university covered up and therefore minimized the risk created by the school's failure to comply with its policies for the admission of such students, and the independent nature of a Title IX coordinator. Now, the very concept of pretext, Your Honors, means that the reason given by an employer is not the true motivation. And this case presents an opportunity for this court to reaffirm two important principles of pretext analysis.
Can I ask you, when did her protected conduct start?
Her protected conduct started approximately around February 5th of that year.
When did UC know about it?
UC knew about it a few days later, and her supervisor knew about it a few days later.
Tell me how.
A couple ways. First, she sent an email to various persons at the institution saying, we need to look into how this person even got admitted. Second, she testified during a meeting with her supervisor.
Being Marshall?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify. Go ahead.
During a meeting with Marshall, she specifically said, I am going to do an investigation into this matter. I believe that the school could be deliberately indifferent, could be in violation of Title IX, needs to offer resources to students.
And she does that before the letter?
Yes, she does that. It's set forth, I think the timeline is set forth in our reply brief, Your Honor.
Right. No, I got the timeline. It's page 6, but I didn't see, and I can pull it up on my iPad, but I didn't see where you said there was a communication with Marshall. I know you say viewed in the light most favorable. I think it's page 6, yeah. Am I right?
Yeah, it's page 6 of the brief, and we cite specifically to, and I think what's most important, the affidavit that she submitted, which is on page 2700 of the record.
That's fair, but the affidavit, at least tell me if I'm wrong, doesn't make clear exactly when she had those communications with Marshall, whereas maybe other documents do. And that's what I'm looking for, is I'm trying to figure out what documents make clear that she had the conversation before the letter.
Yeah, I believe the documents made clear specifically that on February 11th of 2019, she informed her that the office had received complaints. She actually tells a different person that she's going to start an investigation on February 12th, and then she sends the letter to
that
the
vice president. I can't remember her name.
Yeah, the vice president. There's also there was constant communications going on at this time because the university was in the middle of what it perceived as a huge public relations issue. And that's essentially where the problem comes in, because Ms. Goldblum's job is not public relations. Her job is to act as an independent voice at the university, both to offer resources to students and to conduct an investigation into misconduct.
I guess one other question. You fault the university here for not taking action, but I thought the record shows that on February 12th, the dean, Petrin, issues a statement saying, we'll remove it from the article. Then I think it's Merchant directs an investigation of how they let this individual in. And then they later hold a town hall for the students to address concerns. So why isn't that you're saying the university isn't doing anything. That sounds like something to me.
Well, let's look at each of those individual pieces there, Your Honor. When you first have the statement from the dean of the arts and sciences, which is a note that's put on top of the Facebook article or the article online that's there. That actually doesn't necessarily offer resources, because what Ms. Goldblum...
I thought he issued a statement. Yeah, it may have been put on Facebook because, I don't know, kids look at social media these days. That's where all the complaints came to, in social media. But he issued a statement saying that they're going to provide a safe environment, that they are going to remove him from the article, and they're going to take further steps.
Yeah, but Ms. Goldblum has the independent obligation to offer resources to people who may feel that either the actions at the university by admitting the student and honoring him created a hostile environment, or also people who may have been assaulted by this.
I totally get that. But you said at the beginning that the university was trying to cover it up. This doesn't sound like a cover-up. This sounds like the university saying, look, we made a mistake. We're looking into this. We're sorry.
What the university, it's important, I think, Your Honor, to parse what the university admitted it did wrong and what it didn't admit it did wrong. What they did in all these statements is say, we should not have honored this student. But what the university never did was go back and say, why did this student get admitted in the first place?
I thought Merchant directed the dean to look into the role of admitting the student to better understand what went on.
Yeah, and the person assigned to that was the person who replaced Andrea Goldblum. And the record shows very clearly he did nothing to figure out what happened. There was no documents ever retrieved from the admissions office. There was no interview of any of the people involved in his admission. And you just look at the bottom line. The university, nothing in the record suggests that they ever disciplined anyone for not following their procedures in admitting the student, that they ever made any changes in how they admit these students, or took any action whatsoever. In fact, the opposite. What they did is the person who was assigned the investigation, who is Ms. Goldblum's replacement, opened up an investigation, entered his name the day she was terminated as the investigator of the case, took no action whatsoever, and then 30 days later closed the file. What's even worse is there was a second investigation that had been opened up in the system that was actually opened up by the person who was responsible for making the decision to admit this student without consulting public safety. And that person closed the investigation with no work being done. No report was ever issued. No documents were governed. No one ever said to the university community, we screwed up by even admitting this person into the institution without consulting public safety. That's the real cover-up here. They got caught with the fact that they were honoring this person. And they admitted, probably we shouldn't have honored this person without disclosing fully what he did. But they never looked into, for example, let's even make it more specific. The Title IX office received an email saying that this student had sexually assaulted someone on the campus. The university did nothing to look into that allegation and to find out whether that allegation was true. And that's the allegation where you could have had some real exposure financially for the institution. I'm sorry, I thought Your Honor was. So what I think is important here, Your Honors, is to get back to the idea, and the reason this court should reverse, is that the court should do a common sense and full review of the record as a whole. And it's, in this case, Ms. Goldblum should have survived summary judgment because she presented multiple pieces of evidence, which by themselves may not have been sufficient.
You agree she was insubordinate, right?
Absolutely.
You agree insubordination under the rules is a grounds for termination. I know you say they should have engaged in progressive discipline in your brief, but the 3F, or I can't remember the exact section, pretty clearly provides that they can terminate. Right.
They can terminate, but for this court's purposes, when she claims that she was terminated for an improper purpose, this court has to then ask three questions. You have to ask first, was the order that she was given even lawful? Second, if it was a lawful order, was this the type of conduct that under the institution's prior practices would normally warrant termination? And third, was her failure to follow the order the actual motivation for the termination? And this is where we believe the district court made a mistake.
What about our intervening acts case law that you don't deal with in your brief?
There is no intervening act because of the timeline, Your Honor. The timeline is...
Protected conduct comes first, then you have the letter.
Yes. The protect,
you have an intervening act.
The protected the letter itself first could be considered in, also protected conduct. But putting that aside,
the insubordination's not protected, right?
But the intervening acts case law is when there's a situation where the employer is considering terminating the person before the protected activity takes place. And in this case, there was
That's not what our case law says. Did you read Wasik?
I did, Your Honor.
And okay, go ahead. I'll pull up the language for you, and then you can explain.
But even then, I think you have a causal connection here, and that's really what you're looking for in this case. And this court's cases also teach that when she complained about investigating the matter before any termination decision was contemplating, the email, it's on record, the record document number 661, says there may be questions about who knew what when he was admitted. And she had requested the information from the admissions office. I see I think out of my time with rebuttal, but I know Your Honor has a question.
I'll save it for rebuttal.
You can. Do you have further questions at this time, Judge White? All right, you'll have your full rebuttal.
You have Wasik with you? That way you can look at it while you're sitting. It's 472.
I will look it up, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Marissa Palumbo on behalf of the University of Cincinnati. This is a straightforward case of employee insubordination that Andrea Goldblum has attempted to paint as a complicated Title IX matter. Goldblum, in fact, admits that she violated a direct order from her supervisor, Dr. Marshall. And the timeline here is important. At around noon on February 12, 2019, Goldblum sent a draft letter to Dr. Marshall for review. Dr. Marshall expressed concerns about the wording of the letter and directed Goldblum to temporarily hold off on sending it while she discussed the matters with colleagues. Despite this direction, Goldblum texted Marshall hours later at 5:08 p.m. stating, "I am going to send the letter to the editor. If there are any repercussions, I will accept them. I want to be done and go home." And Dr. Marshall responded in no uncertain terms, "I'm on a call regarding the matter. Please do not send." Yet within minutes, Goldblum had emailed the letter to the student newspaper in direct contradiction of her supervisor's order to wait. And the record shows that it is this insubordinate act that led Dr. Marshall to give Goldblum the option to resign in lieu of termination.
How come the student newspaper never published the letter?
That, Your Honor, unfortunately, is not in the record, although I will say that, you know, it is a student newspaper, so my understanding would be that the students make decisions about what goes into the newspaper.
Well, she used the student's name, didn't she, in the letter?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely.
So I would think maybe the newspaper was concerned about publicizing the name of the student involved, and I mean, that also was improper, I think, was it not?
Yes, and that is one of the concerns that Dr. Marshall had about the letter. She had several specific concerns. One, as you identified, that it included the student's name, which would implicate the student's rights under FERPA. And then the letter itself also used the word "we," and she was speaking in the collective when she was not tasked with speaking on behalf of the entire university. And in fact, when Goldblum was asked during her deposition what she meant by that "we," she confirmed that she was referring to the university overall. That's at the record at page ID 815. So there were several concerns about the letter that Dr. Marshall expressed to Goldblum.
Counsel, what do you do about the fact that it was never investigated?
First of all, I disagree with the assertion that it was never investigated. So Goldblum herself opened what's called a Maxient file, and Maxient is a database that was used by the Title IX office for a variety of purposes, but to keep track.
She opened that on February 13th and didn't conduct an investigation. She did nothing further.
That's correct, Your Honor. I was going to get to that. So she opened it on February 13th, the day after she sent the letter, and there's no evidence in the record as to what she did as far as her investigation.
So how does that answer Judge White's question? Judge White said I'm extrapolating, but she's asking, like, Goldblum didn't investigate, and the university opened two investigations and, according to your friend, did nothing. So who investigated?
Respectfully, I believe that's a mischaracterization of the record. So on the date of Goldblum's departure from the university, the investigation was transferred to her successor, Matthew Olofsson. And unfortunately, counsel on the other side did not depose Mr. Olofsson, so there's not anything in the record as to what he did, but the file remained open for a month. And as you noted yourself, Judge Thapar, the university was taking many steps to address student concerns regarding this matter, including holding a town hall for students to express their concerns directly to college leadership. Before that town hall, college leadership met with student leadership to discuss the concerns. Also, the article itself, as you noted, was modified to remove references to the student. And there was an editorial comment posted above the article stating that the references to the student were being removed out of sensitivity to the members of the community. So the university was certainly taking steps. And I think it's important to highlight... Wait,
just so I understand your answer to Judge White's question, you're saying Olofsson conducted an investigation and your friend on the other side, Mr. Engel, would know that if he deposed him into the admissions process.
I agree with that. I think part of it also, part of my answer also is too that you can see in the record that the record, the file was transferred to Olofsson on the date of Goldblum's departure. So if the Maxient file itself reflects that transfer. But as far as Mr. Olofsson's work product, it's not in the record, and again, that's because, unfortunately, he was not deposed in this case. I did just want to emphasize that the Title IX resources that Goldblum claimed that she wanted to share with the students, she herself testified that those were readily available on the university's website. She confirmed that during her deposition, which is page ID 756. And to follow up, on your point, Judge Thapar, earlier, I completely agree that there is a causation here based on the intervening act case law. This is because Goldblum's insubordinate act severed any causal connection, as it was an intervening legitimate reason to discipline her. And I agree that this court's decisions in Wright versus Cellular Sales Management Group and Wasick versus Aero Energy Services are instructive here. In Wright, the plaintiff had filed a second sexual harassment claim only a few days before she was terminated, yet this court found that she had not created a genuine dispute of material fact on causation, stating, even if temporal proximity alone could show causation here, an intervening event interrupted the causal chain. Between the time Wright complained and the time of her termination, she got in a public shouting match with a coworker. And this court found that this intervening legitimate reason to discipline the plaintiff dispelled any inference of retaliation based on temporal proximity alone. So too
what
here.
What about the progressive discipline policy?
Yes, Your Honor, the university does subscribe to the principle of progressive discipline. However, the conduct policy itself contemplates first-time terminations for insubordination, which is what occurred here. So the policy itself does allow for first-time terminations.
Well, it allows for it, but there's also a progressive process. And I know you dispute whether these employees are similarly situated, but plaintiff identified a few employees, I think two in particular, who were subject to progressive discipline for direct insubordination.
Yes, and I do assert, Your Honor, that those employees were not proper comparators because their conduct was vastly different than Ms. Goldblum's conduct. In fact, Goldblum had, she was not only insubordinate by sending the letter, but then the record shows that she went into the Title IX office the next day, the very next day, and boasted to her subordinates about sending the letter in direct contradiction of Dr. Marshall's order to wait. So I believe that that is a distinguishing factor that distinguishes her from her alleged comparators. So in sum, her misconduct was different than those that she points to. She points to someone at the university who took university property off campus and didn't return it when directed to do so. Again, vastly different, where he or she violated her supervisor's direct order, then boasted about it to her subordinates the very next day. And we have to keep in mind, she's a high-ranking university official in a public-facing position, and this conduct just simply is not acceptable for her to be boasting to her team about violating her supervisor's direct order.
Counsel, there's a couple ways to affirm this case, and you argue both in your brief. One is the lack of causation in the prima facie case. The second is the failure to rebut a non-discriminatory reason to establish pretext. Regarding the causation, they argue that temporal proximity here is enough to establish causation. Can you tell me why that argument isn't valid?
Yes, Your Honor. I would point the court to this previous precedent in Wright and in Wasick, in that like in those cases, here we have an intervening act, so Goldblum's insubordinate act severed any causal connection based on temporal proximity alone. So I would point the court to those.
Intervening act, okay, that negates any temporal proximity, okay?
Yes.
All right.
Okay. And it's, just so we're clear, it's undisputed that she started her protected activity before February 12th, as your able counsel on the other side pointed out. The intervening act occurred on February 12th, and thus, and then she opened the HR file that ultimately resulted in the termination on February 13th, correct? Is my timeline right?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so. The one caveat I would say is it's never been entirely clear what Ms. Goldblum's arguing is her protected activity itself, if it's the letter, if it's opening the file.
Well, opening the Maxian occurs on the 13th, but on the, I thought it was undisputed, but you tell me if I'm wrong, that she made known to people that she was conducting an investigation on February 11th. At least she claims that. And your point in your brief, as I understood it, was, well, assuming she claims that, then there's an intervening act on February 12th, which is the letter.
Yes.
Is that right, or am I wrong?
No, you're correct, Your
Honor. I'm not saying you're conceding it, but you say, assuming that's her beef, then February 12th is the intervening act.
Exactly, Your Honor, I agree. And I just wanted to circle back to another point that my colleague on the other side made about a supposedly what they call a fake investigation file. The record does not show that. He's referring to a Maxient file, which again is the database that Title IX used. It was opened by Dan Cummins, and Mr. Cummins testified that he opened that at the direction of his supervisor, Deborah Merchant, for the purpose of securely making these records available for her to access them securely. And Deborah Merchant herself confirmed that, which is during her deposition at page ID 2312. And most importantly, Marshall was not aware of this other Maxient file whatsoever, so it couldn't have implicated her decision here regarding Goldblum's employment. And just one final point. Counsel alleged earlier that the university did nothing in response to an allegation that the relevant student had assaulted another student on campus. Well, in fact, that email from the student came in when Goldblum was at the university and should have demanded immediate attention. However, Goldblum testified that she did not recall reaching out to that student who wrote the email, or whether anyone from the Title IX office reached out to that student either.
Where did she testify to that?
That was during her deposition at page ID 785. So in sum, unless there are other questions, I would respectfully ask that the court affirm the district court's.
I have one question. Do you know when the student reached out via email?
Yes.
If you don't, I can look it up.
Should have that here. If you bear with me for one moment.
I can find it. You said 785.
That is her testimony about the email, yes. It's record 54 at page ID 785.
And is the email in the record as well, or no?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay. Any further questions, Judge White?
No, thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Engel, you've got 3 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. As the court requested, I have pulled up the Wasik decision on my computer, and I think that there is some important language in there that addresses the court's question. In the Wasik case, it said that the employer had an intervening legitimate reason to discipline the employee.
I assume it's legitimate just for a second. You agree that if you have protected conduct and then, because your point earlier was, if protected conduct comes first, the intervening act is irrelevant. But the word intervening implies it's something different than coming, right? So you have before intervening act. If it's a legitimate intervening act, meaning insubordination would qualify, obviously, then unless your theory is right and they can be insubordinate and the university has no recourse, then you lose.
Neither choice is correct, Your Honor. I mean, I'm troubled by the fact that in many ways retaliation is always a intervening act. I mean, this court's cases, when you talk about retaliation or acts that occur after the protected activity, has warned against institutions pouncing on misconduct that may be minor, that takes place after the protected activity as an excuse to terminate someone. So if the rule is that you just do
that just negates temporal proximity. It doesn't kill the case. All it does is we say we look at temporal proximity when you have protected conduct and immediate discipline. If you have an intervening act, that negates temporal proximity being the basis for causation. That's all our case law says. It doesn't say we throw the case out then.
Well, let me address it on that level then, Your Honor, which is two responses. First is, even if you say that temporal proximity is not an automatic factor, it certainly still remains a factor that the trier of fact can consider in terms of when that intervening act occurred. And second, the court still needs to look at whether that underlying intervening act and the discipline that came out of it was legitimate. So it's not enough. This is the whole point of our case, Your Honor, which is it's not enough to simply say she violated some rule at the institution and therefore we can fire her. It's fair game to do whatever we want to her at that moment, regardless of our motives. That's not what this court's cases teach. This court's cases teach that when you have that situation where when someone engages in protected activity and then later is charged with violating a workplace rule, you still have to delve into whether the discipline for that workplace rule was legitimate, whether that workplace rule would normally lead to termination, whether violation of that workplace rule would normally result in other cases at the institution. And I know I'm out of time, but...
Those are all things, you're right. But all I'm saying is it negates temporal proximity. And I agree with you. You don't just throw the case out. You look at everything else at that point.
And if I may, Your Honor, I know I'm out of time, but I'm pushing back slightly, and maybe it's a slight disagreement, but I think it's important, is that when you say negates temporal proximity, assuming...
As a decisive
factor, but it's not something you can just ignore at that point. And so when you have this case, the fact that it's occurring right afterwards is certainly a significant factor that when you combine the fact that it happened right afterwards, that the university has never terminated someone for this type of insubordination before, you have all sorts of record, it certainly gets you over the prima facie barrier.
All right. Any further questions, Judge White? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be submitted.